Thank you. the low bottom, what's above it can come back a little bit now, and we can take the level down in here. And hello, I was just talking about Stanley Watson backstage. I haven't completely forgot this is where I met Stanley, and where I first learned what the Bronze Age had to do with the guitar. Stanley was the guy who walked up to me one night somewhere. He ran into me a couple of years after we'd met and told me if I kept playing like that, I would ruin my arm. And if you don't know Stanley, he was, among other things, a guitar teacher. And within, I think, about 2 years, my arm was ruined. I've never known whether it was me that did it or Stanley. Powers of suggestion are always underrated, and especially with a mind like mine. If you're as easily amused as I am, you're entirely suggestible. And I always, I joined the Navy when I was 17 because somebody told me I could really have a great time there. And I realized my mistake the day after I'd done it, but you can't resign. And I wound up on a submarine called the Halfbeak. It was my first time on the stern planes, and I was told to put a 5-degree down bubble on the boat. I was to tip the boat so that it sank properly as we went down to crush depth, which was about 50 feet, I think. This was the second oldest submarine in the Navy. And 10 degrees in those boats, which were, by the way, invented by the Germans. They were identical to the U-boat. And initially ran on kerosene, but that didn't work. So these were converted to diesel, and we were sinking as we intended to, but at more of an angle than I had been asked to apply. Because, I'm here to please. And, I turned to the guy, the OD, who was literally, I said, I think what I said was 20-degree down bubble, which is 10 degrees twice what is out of control in those boats. And if you ever, and that's an extreme angle. You see people leaning about like this. It's more than you would expect. I'm not sure why I'm telling you this, but it seemed to be a reason for it. When I started, I've forgotten what the reason is now that I'm done. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. say that Louise was not half bad. It was written on the walls and window shade. And oh, she'd act the little girl. But is she bird or believer? That's her trade. Sometimes a bottle of perfume, flowers, and maybe some lace. Men brought Louise 10-cent trinkets. Their intentions were easily traced. And everybody knew at times she cried. Ah, but women like Louise, they get by. Everybody thought it kind of sad when they found Louise in a room. They'd always put her down below their kind. Still some cried when she died. Every time I see these news reports about abuses in nursing homes, I think of a tour manager I used to work with. named Dave. I met him when he was working with, I mean, he's done this with the Rolling Stones and The Who, and when I met him, he was working with Procol Harum. He was instrumental in jump-starting my career single-handedly, and for no reason other than liking the record, he took this thing around to record radio stations as he toured with these other bands. Anyhow, years later, I wound up on the road with him and Procol Harum in Europe, where I got to know, you know, much more than I wanted to about his methods on the road. He's a great guy if you're not working with him, but if you're working with him, you're in big trouble. That's why, after observing this, you know, with Procol, they put them through hell, I hired him. I'll never figure out why I did that. You should live in Dave's hands at Sunnyland Park and count their little days there turning into dark. And won't you tell me how I can see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. I can see you now. Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Everybody lies. Pointy things on these chairs here. It does that all the time. I don't care. No, really, I had the misfortune once of falling in love with a guitar, and I'll never do that again. They will go sooner or later through your own neglect or someone else's, or they'll be stolen. Or and then what do you do? When my 12-string was stolen, I wound up having to finish about 3 jobs. This is in the very beginning for me. I was out playing with John Fahey, who gave me my whole career, and I've always kind of thought was the guy who stole my guitar. And I'd wound up stuck in Los Angeles, which is a city I, you know, you don't want to be there, is the way I look at it. And I was playing a week at the Troubadour on a guitar that, I, you know, the closest thing I could find to a replacement at the time, and 12 strings were much more screwy then than they are now. And I was playing this piece of wood that had a 28-inch scale, which is like trying to, you know, suck a Coke through a straw that, you know, extends out through the other room somewhere. You don't have that much diaphragm, that much suck in you. You're not going to get any Coke. You try and grab this thing, and it's just awful. And I was up there pissing and moaning about my horrible guitar and being thoroughly unprofessional and a real little brat because my guitar had been stolen. And I was backstage up in the dressing room moping and looking for electrical cord and ammonia. And a guy walked in named Dick Rosmini, who was a wonderful guitarist and someone you never hear about and haven't for like 20 years now, who put out a record that I had heard, and instrumental steel string guitar, and he showed up. He walked in, and I was amazed that this guy was there and that he'd come to hear me play, and he didn't really say anything. He said, "Hello, I'm Dick Rosmini," and I said, "Oh, I know. How are you?" And he said, "Let me see your guitar," and he picked up this thing that I had and played. Oh, it was beautiful. He just played this wonderful, beautiful stuff, just like liquid. And I said something like, "Wow," and he said, "See, if you know how to play, it doesn't matter what guitar you got." And then Stanley Watson came, told me I was going to break my arm if I kept playing like that. This isn't an easy job. I'm going to play a song I've played a couple now that are on the, I've made another record when I realized how many I'd made, it was too late to stop. It'll be out in the end of June. It's called One Guitar, No Vocals. You know, they wanted me to indicate somehow that this was a solo guitar record, and I said, "Well, that won't be hard." Which was a refreshing change from what I usually hear, which is, "Leo, what you need is a chick singer. If you had a chick singer, we could get you on the radio." And they scour the earth, you know, for anyone female who might be willing to sing with me, and I run and hide, and so far I've gotten away with that. And the other thing they tell me is that I need a Christmas album, and if I'd give them a Christmas album, my career would take off, and they'd make a lot of money, and I'd make a lot of money. And I've told them the reason people still come to hear me play is because I have not made a Christmas album. And thank you. I know it's true. I'm sick of those things, you know, and you tell them, "Look, hasn't it been done?" And all those other, you know, all the other obvious reasons not to do it. And it just doesn't mean anything to the corporation. So my label was fired recently, along with, and so was Windham Hill. Both of these are owned by BMG. And I was retained. My label was gone, but I was retained. Taj Mahal was retained, and Etta James was retained. So it was great company, but where were we? And what the hell is this all about? I've never seen anything like this happen. One day I got a call from a sort of a ghost phantom sort of A&R department. I didn't know who they were, what label they were affiliated with, but it was me. It was mine. They owned me, and they said, "You know, Leo, we've got a Christmas album coming out." This is my first thing I've heard from them. Christmas album. I said, you know, I played in Denver not too long ago, and Michael Murphy came backstage, and he said, "You know, I made a Christmas album with a chick singer." He said, I think it was Susie Boggess. He made a lot of money. And anyhow, this time around, I couldn't weasel out, and I said, do I have to do the whole record? They said, no. And I said, all right, I'll write you one. So this is called Accordion Bells, and I've learned that a lot of people don't know that these really exist. It's that paper. It's accordion paper, and you open it up, and it's a bell. or a pumpkin, you know, if it's Halloween. And I can't, to this day, I can't get over that when that happens. It's better than TV. Merry Christmas. Telephone rings, somebody says, baby, what you doing? I've been wondering where you've been, Now and then I think about you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall, 'cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on in, baby, we'll laugh and sing, and we'll make love, let the telephone ring. Ring, ring, doorbell ring, baby, come on in, I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around. I've been feeling down, talking to Tony and Mario. You know they make good conversation, still it ain't no consolation. 'Cause I got love, baby, I'll give you some. And if somebody comes, let the doorbell ring. There's a piece on Pee Wee Russell that was written by Whitney, and I can't pronounce his last name, so a jazz critic for somebody or other, and we'll call him Whitney, who interviewed Pee Wee Russell, who used to, a friend of mine used to work with Pee Wee, not for long, but they were in a band and somewhere, and Pee Wee said, "Would you?" One night he said, "Would you help me out? I got to get my car up behind the club. I can't move it. It's, you know, it won't run. And maybe if we all pushed it, maybe we could get it up here." And I said, "Okay." The car was, I think, a station wagon, and it was blocks and blocks away from the club. And the band pushed this damn thing all the way up behind the club into the dirt back there, and they were exhausted and they were done and they were upset. And they said, and Buell, the bass player who told me this, said to Pee-wee, did we really have to do this? I mean, what's the difference whether your car, which can't run anyhow, is sitting here or out down the block? And he said, and he turned the mirror and he said, oh, I needed the mirror so I could do my hair. Pee-wee didn't really have hair. So there's a streak in Mr. Russell that may have been hard to live with. And in this story that his wife tells, Pee-wee has left, and he's been gone for 3 years. He just got up one morning and said, I'll be back. And 3 years later, he was back, and she was working in a nightclub somewhere, and someone told her, Pee-wee's here, and she said, hell with him, and she went off and hid in the kitchen. And while she was there, another one of the waitresses came back and said, oh, you should really talk to this guy. Even his feet look sad. So I read that, and I burst into song. Thank you. gets better and better, doesn't it? Like a stone on water, I can't help but see that another man's love means more to you than the love you stole from me. There's no good. He's good for you, but let me explain. He's twice the price you already paid. Just wait for the change, and we'll be back together. And it can't be the same. For some reason, the problem is that I have a habit of speaking before I know what it was I was going to say. I'm aware that there's some school of thought that says you don't have to know what you're going to say if you're going to open your mouth, but I think when you're on stage, you should have some idea. I mean, after all, doing this tune at a guy's house named Tom Bresch. We were passing a guitar around. Chet Atkins was there, a couple other guitar players. I was talking to Chet the other day, and we about guitars, which is all we ever talk about, or guitar players, and But somehow we wound up talking about dentists and dentistry and gas. And Chet really likes gas, but he said, I don't think you can get it anymore. And he told me about the first time he'd gotten it somewhere up, you know, north. And during his experience with the gas, he played a long, he said, duet with another guitar player, a gas duet. He said the other guy was really good. Anyhow, I played this tune, and Chet said, what's that called? And I said, Peckerwood. And he said, oh, I love that word. And he knew it as it's by its third definition, if you look it up in my dictionary, which is woodpecker in the South. He hadn't heard that of the first two definitions, the first one being white trash and the second being poor white trash, which seems like, you know, a redundancy to me. But there was a time, and I wrote this tune because of this, that I aspired to be white trash, and I don't think I had to work very hard at it. I lived in Oklahoma at the time, and we'd moved there from Wyoming, and I was deprived. I had no money. I was ignorant, and I was pissed off, and I think that all amounts to, you know, the club. But and I much appreciated people like me, which was mainly a guy named, and this is was his name, Sam Smith. And Sam didn't have, Sam had nothing. And anything that he could get his hands on, he held on to for all it was worth. And we were part of a biology class. We were both fascinated with biology. Mainly we were ghouls, and we liked dissecting things. We had dissected, you know, you start with a worm, and then a frog, and then a squid, and maybe a fetal pig, and lots of formaldehyde. That's what I remember the most, which is not how it's done anymore. They realized that, you know, you'll become one of the exhibits if you hang around that much formaldehyde. We had a guy named Mr. Grelling. His first name was Mr. His parents called him Mr., who smoked like a fiend up in front of the class and in the formaldehyde and everything and all these pig guts. And he'd say, you know, don't do this, whatever. And he was a real angry guy. Whatever you do, don't smoke. But we admired him. Sam had found, keeping an eye out for things that he could use, had found a dead horse. It was by the side of the road on the road out toward this country club, and we decided we would dissect the horse. We'd had enough training and other things, and so we told Mister that we were going to dissect this horse, thinking he'd be, you know, impressed. Instead, he was, as you might have guessed, he was alarmed. And he was very cool about it. You know, he tried not to kill our thrill, and we said, you know, we're going to get some kitchen knives and some of those gloves, you know, that you wear when you wash dishes, and you know, dissect the horse. Well, that'd be great, Mr. Grelling. And he said, well, you know, when you poke that knife in the horse, it could explode. That's all we needed to know. It went back to frogs. To give you an example, I mean, about Sam's hanging on to things, we were dissecting, a frog on our own time in the backyard at my house. And had his parts laid out and everything. And my mother decided that we should eat. And she said, get in here and eat. So we went in and ate. And when we went back out to continue with the frog, the stomach was gone. We couldn't find the stomach. Sam had put it in his pocket. It's my stomach. How much are the tickets here tonight? Where are they going?
Thank you.
When I was a kid, we moved from Oklahoma my last year of high school to Washington, D.C., and I got to hear all of a sudden guitar players. There weren't any in Oklahoma, none that I could find, and there were a lot of them around Washington. I remember walking around downtown on my way to DuPont Circle one day and seeing a line around the block. I went up to the front of the line. There was a door next to it that you could walk in. I walked in. It was a record store, and in the record store at the end of the line, which stretched out around the block, were John Hurt and Skip James, and they were signing records. Neither man could read or write, and they had a block of people's records to sign, and they were doing them the courtesy of, you know, working out that signature that they'd memorized, but it took them a long time. And that night, I went down to see John Hurt play at a place called the Ontario Place, and he was what I expected, a human dumpling with the most radiant smile I've ever seen. Somebody that you would, just love to be around to talk to. And of course, to listen to. He had this softness in his playing that no one else has had. And his wife was with him. Now, he was wearing this hat that he must have been wearing for the last 50 years, because I'm sure from the way it looked that it held his skull together and that he would never remove it. And as far as I know, there does not exist a single picture of John Hurt without that hat. It's a horrible-looking thing. And his wife, who was right down here at the front of the stage, it was a little bitty place, looked worse than his hat did. And I mention that because he did this tune, and every now and then in the course of it, and everybody has their own way through it, he'd look down at her and give her one of those smiles that he had. Two teeth in it, but it was blinding. Corina, where you've been so long. Corina, Corina, where you've been so long. And I've been worried about you ever since you've been gone. Last time I played here, there was a support act, I don't remember his name, who was sitting in it was the same club but a different building. Okay. And we were in the dressing room there before he went on and he didn't look too good. And I said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I just got back from my vacation." I said, "Yeah, I guess it can be kind of rough." "Where'd you go on your vacation?" And he said, "Hanoi." I said, "What'd you go to Hanoi for?" And he went, "What's in Hanoi?" And he said, he didn't answer the question. He said, "I have malaria." And he said, it's like acid. It just keeps coming back and back. And the stage manager came around. He said it was showtime. And the guy went up to the stage. And I followed him up because I didn't want to miss this. I wasn't sure what I was going to see. And he got up on stage and he sat down and he did one of these. And he looked up and he said, "I have malaria." So it was a real dynamic evening that last time. But this is a great job in all kinds of ways. And it's a wasted life in some kinds of ways. And, you know, among other things, you do wind up all over the place. You're not there for long, but you are there. And I've been touring, you know, Australia since 76. The only time I've ever seriously considered suicide was in Australia. I had three days in Adelaide with nothing to do. I thought, well, suicide would be arresting. But, you know, who's going to do that? Not me. And something always happens to me there. I, it never failed. I got stuck in a hole in a cave while diving off of Perth. I've never done that anywhere else, but there in Australia, and of course I'm diving on the wrong side of the country. The reef is over here, but I'm diving over here where the effluent is. So following these people around, and there's a hole in the back of this cave. And I don't think, even underwater anywhere else, I would have thought, oh, I think I'll go through that hole. But it looked just, you know, because I was in Australia, I thought, oh, I'll go through that hole. That'll be great. And the guy ahead of me went through it, and he was bigger than I was, and he knew the area. So I thought, hell, here I come, and bonk. And I got stuck in the hole. And I really crammed myself in there because he'd gone through. But now I'm stuck in the hole, and I had to think how this happened. And well, I didn't have to, but you will, you know, if it ever happens to you. And I realized that what had happened was this guy had swum up to the hole, blocked all the light, so it was pitch black, and then swum into the side of the cave. So it just looked like he went through the hole. So here comes, you know, the American, and blip. And I thought, well, he'll come back and get me. And then I thought, well, does he even like me? And then I thought, I'm now plugging the only light in this cave. How is he even going to find me if he decides to go looking for him? But he obviously found me. Anyhow, things keep happening. This I wrote, I got a couple more things here I want to do. And this I wrote in my room in the Siebel townhouse in Sydney last year. It's called Snorkel. My room was flooding. I thought this was an appropriate response. All of the notes in this tuning are the same, except for one. I mean, they're octaves, or, you know, why? What's so hard about tuning this? If that's like, what's the second letter in the alphabet? You know. Thank you. Well, thank you for coming out and coming back and whatever it is, and thanks for listening. It's a pleasure to be back. I hope I see you next year. And we can mute the vocal mic. Thank you. the same key. This is one of my favorite guitar tunes. This is written by Duane Allman. This came to him in a dream.